Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is Now or Never, and we've got Tammy Young from Wyoming with us. Welcome back. Excuse me, Tammy.
Thank you.
And in our last content show that we did, we were kind of talking about the minting of gold and silver coin. And I threw it out there that no state can admit or basically mint their own coin, that only the federal government could do that. And I think I threw it out there. If I didn't, I meant to. Didn't Wyoming pass a measure or pass a bill or start pushing itself down this path of minting their own gold and silver coin?
I don't know about minting their own gold and silver coin. They were talking about digital currency.
Okay.
Creating their own digital currency.
Oh, okay. Well, that's... So that's a different violation, because the only thing a state can do, and this is in the Constitution, it's Article 1, Section 10. And Article 1, Section 10 prohibits any state, and this is what it says. It says, no state shall, and then there's this whole list of things that they shall not do. No state shall enter into a treaty, alliance, or confederation. No treaty shall grant letters of marque and reprisal. No state shall coin money. No state shall emit bills of credit. No state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debt. No state shall pass any bills of attainder, express festival, blah, 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 blah. So the key right there is they shall not allow anything other than gold and silver coin to be the payment or the tender in payment of debts. In other words, if you're going to make transactions in the state of Wyoming regarding debt, you know, somebody owes money, they have to pay that back. The only mechanism to do that would be with gold and silver coin. So if you want to go and buy something and you're doing it, so it's one thing between private parties to barter commodities. That was clearly legal. But when there are institutions within the state that are sanctioned by the government, these institutions must use and must require gold and silver coin to be the payment for the debt. Does that make sense?
I mean, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right. So, any state creating digital currency or allowing digital currency for a... because you see it online now. You can buy things using Bitcoin. Those, you know, allowing retailers or allowing businesses of any form, e-commerce or what have you, to be able to use a digital currency, even paper currency, even a check. Mm-hmm. Now, they never included, and I believe that the spirit of the law was being adhered to when they created commutable bills. In other words, for every bill that was cast or printed, there was a cast coin in a bank somewhere in the United States that the Federal Reserve, or I should say not even the Federal Bank, the Treasury, had the adequate amount of gold and silver to basically back every bill out there. That if everybody all of a sudden wanted to commute their bills back to coin and silver, you know, gold and silver coin, then all they needed to do was go to the bank. Now, it would be unreasonable to think that every bank would have a repository, because the requirement is only to have a coin for every bill. If it's a gold coin, then there would be a gold coin associated to that bill. Now, technically, they should probably have, because what you want to do is you want to maintain, you know, a surplus in coins and a... you know, a restriction on the bills so that you never have too many bills in circulation that would actually suck up all your coin. The problem is it's not unreasonable. And this is how the panic in New York started, because who was the guy? What was the guy's name? Chase was his name. When it comes to me trying to pull out an important name, especially at a point like this, it's just like it eludes me. The names just slip through my fingers, folks. But dates and those types of things, I have a better recall on that type of stuff. But anyway, the guy that did the run on banks, I'm positive his last name was Chase. And what he did was he went into six different banks and he deposited money over time. He knew, because he was a banker himself, but he knew that these banks would only maintain 20% of cash in their holdings. So over time, as he knew that he held or deposited more than 20% of what the bank would be holding, then he went in to try to cash out and demanded they give him all the cash, and they didn't have enough to pay him. So he walked out with all of their cash out of six of these banks, and this was considered the run on banks. In one day, he was able to basically deplete the cash supply of six banks, where everybody that tried to go in after him and tried to do any, you know, give me cash for this or cash a check, anything like that, where they were trying to get cash, all of a sudden he created a panic in the state of New York. And so what he basically did was he created a problem where the solution was to get the federal government to be involved in this. And so as I see this, and as I kind of look at what he did, and this is just par the course. This is exactly what manipulators do. They cause a problem, and then they come in with, hey, we've got a great solution, and then everybody gets on board.
So just doing some Googling, that Wyoming did pass in 2018 a Wyoming Legal Tender Act. This legislation made it possible for gold and silver to be used as legal tender in Wyoming.
Okay.
Removed state taxation from transactions involving these metals.
Okay, so did it give them the ability to mint the coins or just restored the law that says people can use gold and silver coin?
Don't believe it gave them ability to mint, just
okay.
to store.
Because I remember hearing from somebody that they were at the cusp of minting their own coin because the federal government's not doing it. And so I go, okay, well, yeah, that it's good that somebody's doing something proactive, but what we're supposed to be doing is holding the federal government accountable for those right. specific things that they're supposed to do. And so you going and doing it because they're not is not really how it's supposed to happen. But anyway, okay. All right. Well, it'll come to me probably in the next few shows down the road. I'll remember what Chase's name was. But he was the guy that basically paved the way to set up the Federal Reserve. And he was, I believe, a front man for the Rothschilds and the global banking schema that they were setting up. And this was the next step, critical step of getting America into this globalism cabal. And so there we go. That was the next step they needed. And, you know, they're so close to having us, folks, that if we don't start demanding full compliance, and if it's got to start at your local level. But anyway, where we left off in Article 9, and it was the last. Okay, so the paragraph that we're starting off with is the United States and Congress assembled shall have authority to appoint a committee to sit in the recess of Congress to be denominated, quote, a committee of the states. And so do you know where we're at now? Are you following me?
No.
Okay, let's get you there. Okay, so technically, if I go count nine, there's one, two, three, four paragraphs. The fifth paragraph starts off with the United States and Congress assembled.
Okay.
There we are.
Just had to catch
so
up
now everybody work. Else is up with me because they've got, I know you all have the Articles of Confederation sitting right there in front of you. And this is where they're talking about their powers and, you know, creating this convoluted court system and so forth. Now, to keep in mind, these court systems were not necessarily even admired at all. The people did not want to see a national court that could affect them. And so I actually got into this in my new article coming out, because that is where the states really started pushing back, even with the Constitution, which is why the 11th Amendment was passed so quickly in the beginning of this Republican experiment. Anyway, go ahead.
Okay. The United States and Congress assembled shall have authority to appoint a committee to sit on the recess of Congress to be denominated a committee of the states and to consist of one delegate from each state and to appoint such other committees and civil officers as may be necessary for managing the general affairs of the United States under their direction.
Okay, let me have you finish that. This is a long sentence, though. So okay. Let's go down to the semicolon. Just keep going.
Oh, okay. To appoint one of their members to preside, provided that no person be allowed to serve in the office of president more than 1 year in any term of 3 years.
Okay.
To ascertain the... Oh, okay, yeah, right there.
Okay. So what they're doing is they're basically allowing themselves to go into recess. And when they go into recess, there will be, at a minimum, a committee of one person from each state so that this general government... Because it was a general government, not a federal government. They were very clear in a confederation, it was a general government. Now, in this Republican form of government that we have, they called it a general government as well, not a federal government, because they abandoned the idea of setting up a federation of states. They maintained a confederation of states and delegated very specific powers to it instead of delegating the bulk of powers, leaving very few powers left for the states. Folks, go look up the definition of a federation and then look up the definition of a confederation, and you will walk away with this, wow, we don't have a federation. We actually have a confederation based on the limited powers delegated. Go ahead. You're going to say something?
No. Okay. I was just looking up federation and confederation.
Oh, okay. Well, while you're looking it up, have you found it? Because if you found it, what's a quick definition of a federation? Because helping people, you know, hear the words, because then they can go look it up and see it for themselves. I don't want people to take our word for it. The reason we read these things is so that we're not trying to paraphrase, skim over, and tell people this is what it said, this is what happened. We want to read it so that you hear exactly what it said, not what we think it said or what we want you to understand it said. Because remember, folks, the reason Christianity was suppressed and got perverted quickly under the Roman Catholic Church, under the Caesar of Rome, was they started dictating what the scripture said. And they used the scriptures in the control and manipulation of the people. They never gave you the full context of the scriptures. They wanted to make sure that they kept the people, you know, docile and controlled and so forth, instead of freeing them with the full word of God. And so over time, people started realizing that, you know, hey, there, and as a matter of fact, it was Martin Luther that recognized how far they drifted and called them out and said, you need to get back in line with the scriptures, and the people need to have the scriptures. That didn't happen. So he made it happen. And this is how the undoing of this I'll just say this abomination of Christianity, you know, began. It all began in the 1500s. Technically, in government, it began in the 11th century. But in actually challenging the veracity of the Catholic Empire, that took even longer time, and that started happening in the 16th century. Did you look up federation? Do you have a basic definition of a federation? Now, be ready to go to a definition of a confederation, because we need to compare and contrast. What is the difference between a federation and a confederation? Go ahead. What's a federation?
Well, it's saying the United States is it.
It's saying it is, right. But what are the powers delegated in a federation?
It says a federation is a political entity characterized by a union of partially self-governing states or regions under a central federal government. And a federation, the self-governing status of the component states, as well as the division of power between them, and the central government is typically constitutionally entrenched and may not be altered by a unilateral decision of either party.
Okay. So,
and it says examples include United States, Germany, Australia.
Okay. And so what I will do, because I will look up another definition, a simple definition of a federation, but go ahead. And what is a confederation?
It says a confederation is a union in which several states come together for a common purpose but retain a high degree of their sovereign powers and freedoms. In a confederation, the central authority is typically weaker than the individual states, and decisions made by the central body often require unanimous approval by all member states.
Okay, so in...
It sounds more like what we are.
Yeah, so absolutely. And so in Wikipedia, a federation is a state consisting of a union of partially self-governing states or territories. Now, when we look at the Constitution, does it say that the states are partially self-governing?
Yeah.
Or are the states fully sovereign?
They're fully sovereign.
There you go. So the only powers that the federal government has are those few powers. So in other words, does the federal government have the power over health?
No.
Education?
No.
Housing?
No.
Labor?
No.
Transportation? Infrastructure?
No.
Oh, no. So I could go on and on and on and on. Environment? Energy.
No.
And it was clear that the federal government, or I should say the general government, because it truly is just a general government, it serves the states. When the federal government basically, or I should say, I use the little f federal, not capital F federal. The difference is a capital F federal is really more of a federation federal. The generic term of a little f federal is, you know, a minor federal government. And because they did refer to it commonly interchangeably between a general government and a little f federal government, not a capital F federation. And so when Madison's plan and the Virginia plan was submitted, we went over this last year, folks, when the plan was submitted in the early part of the convention, it was rejected because if they would have created a federation, all of the states would have lost their suffrage and sovereignty,
right,
which means the little states would have been swallowed up and their culture, their religion, all of these things could have been crushed. So they wanted to make sure they created a government, a general government that served the states, that did not have the power to invoke any religious changes in their lives, invoke any commerce changes in their life. This general government had this, it was kind of like to be the peacekeeper between the states, to make sure that the states weren't going after each other and basically dividing themselves and creating these factions of North and South. The concept of a North and South faction, being erected and existing in this union is contrary to what should have happened. The general government should have been able to step in and say, hold on here, you guys can't be doing this. And the general government never should have participated in the warfare against the southern states, nor should it have participated in inflicting slavery. There were so many different violations that were these little... I believe at the time, the men that watched these things happen, like James Monroe, these were nuances to them. They said, okay, well, this is a political compromise, and it seems okay. And he had no idea. Understanding the importance of basically protecting the freedmen, right? Okay, so we're going to go back over some stuff that I've already said. That James Monroe was the one guy that actualized Jefferson's plan of helping freemen, black freemen in America, get back to Africa to be repatriated to their homeland. But they knew they couldn't be repatriated to where they came from. So what we did, and this was not constitutional, but this was the moral thing, so they violated the Constitution in doing this. They bought land in Africa, and they basically made it a free land, and they granted it to the people, the freedmen, the free Africans in America, to send back so that they would be able to live in their own land of liberty. Monroe was the guy that actualized this. But so here I'm torn. I'm absolutely torn. What the heck is going on with this guy? He understood the importance of, you know, helping these people get to a point of liberty. And then on the other hand, he basically foreordained that states coming into the Union had to be slave states. Why didn't he veto these actions? Why didn't he stand up and say, not on my watch?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, Monroe is one of those guys I definitely want to talk to, you know, in the next life. Or, you know, when we all, you know, start singing Kumbaya, when we, you know, because these questions, you know, just vex me. It just doesn't make sense why he did some of the things that he did. I think the same thing with Jefferson. I'm not judging these guys. I'm not in their shoes. I wasn't there. But I do know that these things fly in the face of the Constitution, i.e. the Missouri Compromise. I know that what they were doing, and again, it goes down to this was a one-time transgression, not a permanent transgression. I want to be clear here, folks. The Department of Transportation, when Congress tried to create that under Madison, Monroe, and Jackson, that would have been a full-time transgression. The Alien Sedition Acts would have been a full-time transgression against the Constitution. This creating, buying land off the coast of West Africa and basically making it so that the freedmen of the United States would have a place to go and establish their own government and basically live under the in a land of liberty unencumbered by what would have been seen as a systemic racial white government. Because that's what ended up happening for decades and decades, for centuries. And so why, you know, I'm sorry, I went down this path of how this is vexing, but the point is this, that was a one-time, you know, transgression. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And I believe that in some cases like that, you know, maybe the men should have stepped down because they had an oath, right? And they did this and they really believed they needed to do this. And I think that they should have done it. But I think maybe Monroe should have stepped down after doing that. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Because he understood the importance of the oath, and we're going to go into a break in just a second here. But he understood the importance of the oath. And so as I see this, as I look at how, you know, he was under oath as the president, was responsible for executing the laws and did something. He executed an act that was not within the Constitution. I think with all, you know, moral consciousness, he should have stepped down. But this doesn't happen. And as a matter of fact, why didn't it happen? That's another question. We'll be right back. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so welcome back. And actually, this begs another question, because I'm okay with a one-time transgression, but I'm not okay with it not being passed. As a matter of fact, I honestly think that something should happen. That if a president or a member of Congress, or I should say a body of Congress, does a transgression and it is identified that, hey, if you do that, that will be a transgression. I think that there has to be some process that basically steps in and says, look, you know, the power wasn't there. No, nor do we want to actually give them that literal power permanently, right? And so consider this. If we amended the Constitution to allow the United States government to go and actually set up governments, independent governments throughout the world, that would be a bad thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I could see them actually doing pretty evil things and manipulating governments and so forth, because this would be where they would actually be able to manipulate foreign governments.
I mean, they're already doing that, just not.
Absolutely. Those are
just not constitutionally.
Correct. And those are transgressions. They're consistent transgressions because we're continually manipulating governments in the world, along with other players. And I believe that there is, you know, the Mutt and Jeff routine. It's kind of like when a person is being suspected of a crime, they go into an interrogation and you have like these opposing forces, like the United States and Russia, the good cop, bad cop. But they're both working together to basically get you to go one way or the other. It doesn't really matter which way you go, you're basically going into their arms. And so I look at these things and I go, well, there may have been a way of doing this where, you know, the states could have said, we will allow this. Instead of it being a treaty, it would have been like a one-time application, kind of like a treaty, where the states would say, you know what? The good that what you're doing, we do not want this power to be a permanent power delegated. But this one-time application might be, and this has to be actually within the Constitution, to allow the states a single, I don't want to say an indiscretion, but a single act as a potential. This requires, I think, some very mature minds and eyes in looking at how that language would be so that it could be done and it could be done right, so that the right thing can be done, right? I mean, I know that there is, because I come off as like a manager instead of a leader, but we need to be leading. And I know I'm dealing with a lot of other people that equally come off as managers, because when we start talking, we talk about doing the right thing, or not doing the right thing, but doing things right. In other words, when I talk about Trump needs to work within the Constitution. There is no mechanism to allow him to go outside of it. every other president. They're responsible of working within the Constitution and actually executing the constitutional laws. They're not allowed to actually execute unconstitutional laws. They may be federal laws, but technically, if they understand their oath, they're actually supposed to suppress those laws and say, I'm not enforcing those laws. He can't get rid of them. He's not Congress. He's not the states. So I think that this is kind of like a little, you know, glimmering speck. Go ahead.
Wouldn't that be the same thing? It's just ignoring or nullification?
So what I'm talking about is taking a positive action, spending money, doing something that would be a one-time allowance. But the only way it could – see, you got to remember that we're a union and that the states prevail as the sovereigns, that the states are the parties to that compact, that this general government is the creature to them. There needs to be a mechanism for the creature. Because remember, the president is just a small part of that creature.
Mm-hmm.
And the judiciary is a different part of that creature and so forth. And so I think the states, there needs to be a mechanism in the Constitution that allows the states to basically say, okay, we, you know, instead of making a unilateral decision of the president just doing something, I think that there needs to be an appeal by either the, you know, the branch, the Congress, the president, and or the judiciary, the Chief Justice, to basically make an appeal to say, our hands are tied. We want to do the right thing. But doing things right based on the Constitution doesn't allow us. And in Monroe's case, doing this one right thing, I think that he should have made the appeal to the states to say, we have this problem, and we want to do this, and I want to be able to do this. Can I do this? Now, unfortunately, I think at the time, I don't think that the states would have allowed that because there was, again, there was, I don't know, there may have been this parody. You never know until you actually do it because it's literally just subjection. We're just guessing. So I think that there needs to be a process that if we come across a point where, you know, the president feels so compelled that this needs to be done, or the judiciary feels so compelled that this needs to be done, that they go to the union and say, what say ye? And I don't think it can be done by a 50% vote. I think it needs to be done as a one-time thing by the same rule, by the same three-fourths measure. The real problem is America at that point ready to do that? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Okay. So anyway, this is just an idea that I think we need to do. And as far as I see this as an opportunity to making these minor changes. Because you know, I've already said in previous shows that you haven't even heard, that if the states actually take their role and start basically pulling back all their powers back away from the federal government that it's assumed, then the states are in prime at that point to be able to make some minor changes to the Constitution to empower the body union. And in so doing, that they would all they would need to do is change Article 1, Section 10, in allowing the states to actually form compacts within the union to serve the union over domestic matters, you know, or over national matters. In other words, amongst the union. In other words, they can't be involved in international issues at all, because that was left for the federal government, or I should say the general government, deals with all things external. But all things domestic, the states should have the power to regulate themselves and to come in and come up with solutions for infrastructure and strategies instead of allowing this creature that was created to serve them when actually they're selling them into the global market with disadvantages, like for energy, like for commerce and so forth, like food and really critical stuff. We see how the general government has gone down this path of actually doing everything to our disadvantage and giving the global, the world, the advantages. And that, yeah. I mean, that's antithetical to what they're supposed to be doing. So, and that's only because they have assumed these authorities. It's just like when Obama basically let supposedly the internet outside of the, you know, United States be controlled. Well, it's not our place to control the internet of the world, but it is our place for we to have control of our own domain. And so that would have been something that would have been a part of the infrastructure, you know, polity that the states or the union would need to establish to maintain what is best for the union. Because clearly Obama didn't care what was best for the union by allowing some international entity to start controlling it.
Right.
Ah. And so, and Trump did that with the USMCA. In creating a trade deal, he basically subjugated the companies of the United States to foreign courts. That should never have happened. You see, the federal government does what they think they need to do for the political compromises in the world arena over matters that they don't even have the power to do. Therefore, I believe, if we actually severed that, their ability to even affect anything not delegated, then we would actually be able to stipulate and actually tell them, no, you're not doing that. We're going to do this, and this is how you're going to support us. And in peeling this onion, because I'm going to stop here, because we actually probably need to get back into the Articles of Confederation, but in peeling this onion, I just want to make it this clear, that the states in creating these things will actually be able to then go to the government and say, this is how you will pay this, because they have the taxation. We've given them the tax power, so we want them to maintain what they need to do, but we don't want to constrain them, because that's like killing the goose that lays the golden egg. So we actually have to create a symbiotic relationship between our domestic governing commissions, bodies, whatever, and how they are funded by the federal government. So in other words, every time we increase the taxes, it's not done by the president or by this arbitrary reason. It has been driven by the states themselves. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I digress. Let's actually get back to the Articles of Confederation so we can continue with this instead of, you know, struggling over these little problems in my head. Okay, so to ascertain, go ahead.
Okay. To ascertain the necessary sums of money to be raised for the service of the United States and to appropriate and apply the same for defraying the public expenses. To borrow money or emit bills on the credit of the United States, transmitting every half year to the respective states an account of the sums of money so borrowed or emitted. To build and equip a navy, to agree upon the number of land forces, and to make requisitions from each state for its quota in proportion to the number of white inhabitants in such state, which requisition shall be binding, and thereupon the legislature of each state shall appoint their regimental officers, raise the men in cloth arm, and equip them in a solid like manner.
I think that meant clothe. I think that meant clothe. Raise the men, in other words, raise the war fighters and clothe them, arm and equip them.
Okay. And the officers and men so clothed, armed, and equipped shall march to the place appointed within the time agreed on by the United States in Congress assembled. But if the United States in Congress... I raised my screen.
Okay.
But if the United States in Congress assembled shall, on consideration of circumstances, judge proper that any state should not raise men or should raise a smaller number of men than the quota thereof, such extra number shall be raised officered, clothed, armed, and equipped in the same manner as the quota of each state, unless the legislature of such state shall judge that such extra number cannot be safely spread out in the same, in which case they shall raise officer, clothe, arm, and equip as many of such extra number as they judge can be safely spared.
Okay.
And the officers, I'll read the last sentence.
Uh-huh.
And the officers and men so clothed, armed, and equipped shall march to the place appointed and within the time agreed on by the United States in Congress assembled.
Right. So what I'm going to go back to in what we just read in the since getting back to this, interestingly enough, there's this short little line, right? And it's right up that the states an account of the sums of money so borrowed or emitted, dot, dot. And then to build and equip a Navy, right? So they're covering these things that they're going to do by, and they're separating them by these two dashes. And then the next dash, double dash, is to agree upon the number of land forces. And if you actually go through there, there's no more dashes, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's no more double dashes. If you actually did a search for the double dashes, that would be it in this paragraph. That's the last one. Now, look at how much language is being used from the very to agree from the beginning of that dash. I mean, that's a huge paragraph in itself in dealing with the establishment of land forces. And yet the most important defense that America could have in protecting itself from the invasion or, you know, the external threats is the Navy. And it's just five lines right there. To build and equip, actually six words, to build and equip a Navy. And there's no conscious efforts of how to do that. So see, here's the problem. That even though almost all of these states were coastal states, some of them weren't. Right? Pennsylvania was one that wasn't. And New Hampshire was another state that was not a coastal state. So they wouldn't have anything to do with the Navy. But the rest of the states did. And why is it that there was never an establishment of a national admiral equal to the land force general? When one looks at the chief of staff, the joint chiefs of staff, right, there is one military man over all of, you know, that kind of reports to the president. And this is aside from the Secretary of War, the Secretary of Defense. And when we really look at the beginning days of this new form of government that they were forging as they revolted against Britain, it seemed like the dominance in America was with land forces. In other words, the Navy, I mean, clearly Britain was using American men because George Washington was one of them. George Washington was an officer in the British Army, and he was actually a little bit, and some people say that it was one, you know, the fact that he was not being promoted was one of the reasons why he was okay with probably fighting a war against Britain, because they basically weren't going to promote an American. And so, you know, kind of self-interest type of thing, but I don't think he was that shallow of a man. I don't. But it's one of those things. And the one domain in military space that was prevalent in the colonies at the time was ground forces and the militia. They didn't understand the Navy. They understood the commerce and everything else, but they didn't really take a Navy seriously. And that was, I think, the reason why Britain was able to attack us again in 1812.
Yeah.
They started realizing that they needed to bolster up their defense, and they realized, and actually, if you really look at what it would have taken, they would have had to compromise the militia for a period of time because they only had so many resources and so much money. And to build a good coastal defense was paramount. I mean, Adams really brought that forward when he became president, and Jefferson gave him a hard time. And it wasn't until Jefferson became the president, dealt with, you know, the the Ottoman Empire and the Tripoli, you know, the incident in Tripoli, and the need for a strong navy and coastal defenses. So anyway, it amazes me that because of the lack of understanding of what to do and how to do it, the one thing that they just focused on was the ground forces. But if you ask me, the Secretary of War, the Secretary of Defense, because our greatest strategic need is protecting ourselves from external forces. So I believe that should be the Department of War should really be more consistently, the Secretary of War should be a naval man. And the Chief of Staff should be a naval man. And understanding the international aspects of everything instead of a ground pounder. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think they would have had a better context, especially if there would have been growing pains as a nation in the very beginning. But had the sooner we would have been there, the better we would have been able to protect ourselves. But we never got there. And I'll say this because when you look at the United States, we didn't take a Navy serious until Britain basically took us back. Now, most people don't know, but under the Organic Act and under that treaty, there was enough of an influence where basically Britain was pulling our strings at that point. And that was when, after the Civil War, is when America actually started creating a serious Navy. Now, to be clear, that Navy was being bolstered up, but it was never to be bolstered up based on Britain's designs that it would be subjugated to the British Navy. I mean, that wasn't clearly written out in any documents, but you'll notice that we didn't rise to become the dominant power until, you know, our production capability of building ships basically. I mean, look at Britain. It just doesn't have the ability to build as much as we do. As a nation, we're much bigger than them, and we have the resources, and so it just became the obvious thing that we became a world power, and it was no accident that happened because of I just think the spirit of America, the people, when World War I broke out, we were all, you know, sold in going into being global citizens. And with World War II, boom, you know, the greatest generation jumped at the responsibility of doing that, of doing the right thing. And that's when, you know, it became evident that we were going to become the world power. But it was still evident, and it is evident to me, how we are only a puppet in the scheme of globalism, even though we're the prime puppet. And I say that because we're the prime puppet because we're the ones that have been paying for and subsidizing communism. Because when we look at the breakup of Germany and, you know, how we went in and rebuilt Russia, we went in and rebuilt Japan, and we were the ones that were constantly at our expense doing these things.
Right.
Right. Things that we didn't have the constitutional authority to do, nor did we even have the constitutional authority to send ground forces there, only Navy. I mean, it was one thing for us to be involved in, you know, a policing action and or a naval engagement, but to send ground forces out of the United States to foreign land, the Constitution didn't allow that. The Constitution only gave Congress the power to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, to suppress insurrections within the United States, and to repel invasions within the United States. In other words, if there were invading forces, you know, they could do their job, but not to repel invading forces of other nations. That wasn't there. And so, mm-hmm. I, you know, I know a lot of times when I speak, it may seem like a, you know, a sleight of hand or what have you. There is no enumeration in the Constitution for America to send troops to gauge a ground game with the militia. It doesn't mean that the Navy and the Marine Corps can't be engaged in U.S. interests. We do have a constitutional responsibility in protecting our interest. I mean, Thomas Jefferson exerted that by sending the Marines and the Navy over to Tripoli. And because we've taken a positive foreign policy, because the president is basically the one that sets that, and from that point forward with Monroe and the Monroe Doctrine, that we were going to have a positive foreign policy, that we were going to make sure that bad players were not going to be able to come into our hemisphere or, you know, mingle around in our lanes of traffic. Did that mean that we had the ability? No. So this goes down a long discussion that I think gets people stoked up on, you know, we can't do that, or we can do that, or we can do this, we can't do this. I honestly think that our responsibility is towards liberty and liberating people, that the Constitution was not designed just for the people that lived in North America between these two latitudes and, you know, by, you know, separated by the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans in North America. In other words, it wasn't just for this little segment of land. That the Constitution and liberty could literally, because of the Constitution, could flow to all nations. Those people, again, this goes back to the scale of liberty. If you, you know, I know you didn't hear that, but the scale of liberty is that all people must choose for themselves. And when people truly choose for themselves that they want to have and live in a land of liberty as a state within the United States, then they should be on the path, and we need to make them on the path of becoming a state by creating a territory and so forth. This goes down this concept of, you know, what's going on with Greenland, but I think that this is how we can actually start putting China on its heels and put Russia on its heels in basically empowering the people in those nations to actually stand up and say, we don't want communism anymore. We would rather be a state in the United States. Mea culpa, mea culpa. I actually just realized that we actually had a technical error. And so what I'm doing now is I'm actually interjecting a little pause in the real recording. So you'll need to go to Red State Talk Radio podcast page so that you can actually hear this mistake and actually hear what we really recorded, because unfortunately the show is probably about 57-58 minutes instead of 55, and we never put an end to it, but it's out there, and it was pretty sloppily done. But my apologies, folks. We really do a raw show here, and we try not to do, you know, these types of edits. I try not to cut things out at all. We want to give you those things that fly out of my mouth. And so I know that there's times when people go arg and they actually get frustrated because I say something. But I believe that you're disingenuous when you're always polishing and editing and redoing and so forth. I would much rather make mistakes than be judged as a person that, you know, is so controlling. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description version of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.